Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is September 11th, 2004. The lesson for today is Married to the Mine, Women During the Mining Days. Another session during the Miners' Reunion. Let's listen in.
My name is Rick Dunning. I'm the curator of Holden's Museum, a collector of stories, and that's part of what we want to try and do this morning, is collect some more stories. Before I start into the part of the program that I have planned, I want to allow some time for Linda Carlson to talk. Linda has written a wonderful book on Northwest company towns, and includes Holden very prominently. And the more I read it, the better I like it, the more I get out of it. And, she's talked with a lot of folks that have connections to the mine, so we've seen her at reunion events before. And her book is for sale in the Holden bookstore, and this afternoon is about the only other time you're going to have to make it to the Holden bookstore, since it's not open on Sunday. So make sure you get a chance to get over there. I want to make sure Linda has a chance to talk a little bit about her work.
Rick's topic is Married to the Mine, and I know what he's looking for are stories about people, especially women, and their role here, and what they did if they were children in this community. So he'll talk more to you about that. But I want you to know that part of what I did, but almost all of what I did in writing this book, researching this book, was collect stories. I researched about 300 towns in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, and what I was looking for were those that were truly company-owned or company-dominated, and I was looking for stories just like the stories that you all have been hearing or sharing since we arrived. I want to give you just an overview of how I researched this book, in part to whet your memories, so that when he asks you for stories, you'll have something in mind. And also, if you're thinking about writing a family history or a community history, a church history, whatever, I just want you to know that there's some resources out there that are readily available, and they are wonderfully valuable in whatever you do. I use the memoirs and the local histories. In some cases, I argue with the points they brought up. Now, John Phillips here insists there was a liquor store at Holden, and Charles Lutz's book in the bookstore says there was, but I went to the archives of the liquor board, and they said, no, there wasn't. So that's just an idea when you look at almost everything very critically and say, do I believe that this really happened, and then start double-checking. I talk to company town residents and or their children. I talk to archivists, and I talk to people who work in museums all over the three-state region that I was working in. And I will tell you up front, I was limited to this three-state region because my book was published by the University of Washington Press. And from the point that they saw an interview or an outline of the book, they said, you can only do these three states. That's all we will publish. So just up front, that's why. I use contemporary newspapers like the Holden Miner, which is a wonderful source of nuggets about everyday life. And when the museum is open and you have a chance to look at the files, they're just great. I also went through via the clips here and through the microfilm collections that you find in colleges, the Chelan and Wenatchee papers, to document things. And even in the Seattle papers, we were just talking about the basketball team that went out to the competition in Seattle, and we're talking about going through the microfilm of the Seattle papers trying to document when that was and who was on the team. But for example, Patty Haddon Tappan, who does the Holden Miner today, asked me to go through the PI and find her a wedding announcement from the early 1950s, which I did do, and that was, of course, a side job that isn't in the book. But those are wonderful resources. I use photos, I use floor plans, I use site plans, I use maps, I use train schedules. And I use train schedules not for this community, but there are many communities where there is no trace of that community left, and a train schedule will give you an idea of where some of those communities are or were. Because, for example, I grew up in Pierce County, and there was something called the Tacoma Eastern Railway, which became the National Park branch of the Milwaukee Road, and of course it's completely gone today. And there are some communities which there's no trace of, but by going through the train schedule, I got a sense of where the community of Harding was, for example, because it was so many minutes away from, between different stops. So if you're trying to track down an old family homestead, for example, that's something to use. The photos, and this is where Bill Phillips helped a lot. He helped with a number of photos that you'll see in this book, but the very last photo we got for this book was one that I knew had to exist. And some of you know that I asked and asked and asked over and over again. I wanted a picture of the cars atop the ore canisters going out. And we really worked, and one day he called up and said, I've got the photo. And there were actually two, and at that point, the University of Washington Press was getting kind of cheap about reproducing photos, and so we picked one. But it's a great shot that shows the 1950s era cars, and it shows it leaving the dock at Lucerne with the cars sitting atop the canisters. You saw some of those last night, so there's more available now, but at the time, this was the best shot. And I knew there had to be one, and I knew I wanted that photo, because to me, that was a very special part of life here, and it typified the kind of isolation that people experienced. Floor plans were really important because there are a lot of people who say, well, life in company towns was rugged and your housing was rustic. And in many cases, I was able to find floor plans that indicated that the houses were really very nice. And you see lots of photos that indicate that too. But the floor plans were very helpful, and you could indicate how large the rooms were and compare them to what a comparable town had as far as houses of that era. Insurance records were very helpful because they had photos and plans. And what is interesting is the insurance records for the school districts in Chelan County are complete except for the Holden School. So there was nothing, but there were for many other buildings. And if you're researching, again, the school that you might have attended, that's one thing to look for in a library's special collections are these insurance records. I used census and school records, I used city directories and gazetteers, and I used obituaries. Obituaries were a great way of leading me to the children of people who had worked in these communities, and in some cases the children had not lived here, but they were able to share with me things. So, for example, there was a town called Balsettes in Oregon, and it is famous in part because there was a 9-year-old girl who in the late 30s started a monthly newspaper that was circulated worldwide because of the company owner. They used it as a PR vehicle. They had this 9-year-old girl writing this really very interesting paper. And she unfortunately was dead by the time I started the book, but I was able to talk to her daughter and get more information about her. So those are all the kinds of sources I used. And what I want to share with you, and what I hope will prompt your own memories or your own questions to help work with this work, were the three things that really fascinated me in the towns that I researched. The first is, as you know about Holden, many of these communities were very, very remote, even into the 1950s. I mean, the shopping by mail, many of you shared with me stories about how the women would trace their feet on a piece of paper and send it in to Frederick Nelson or the Crescent in Spokane, and the shoes would come out on approval. And if they didn't fit, back they went. Same thing for those dresses that you saw in the dance scenes here. I was fascinated by the fact that everything came in by boat or came in by railway, and in some railroad towns that was the only way in or out, and when you moved in, you even put your cow in the boxcar and moved in that way. I was fascinated by what existed in what was largely a pre-television era, the fact that the isolation in many of these communities created community spirit and a whirlwind of activities that we don't have today. That there were literally dozens of clubs, dances, classes, sports teams, fundraisers, the movies. I mean, who goes to the movies 3 times a week like they did here? And I remember talking to Harriet Wilbur, who unfortunately died in the spring, and she was telling me about having square dance lessons. And I said, well, how did you have square dance lessons? And she said, well, we had records, and the calls were right on the records. So they went to the Village Center, and that's how they learned to square dance. So there were all sorts of very interesting things people did. And I want to comment briefly on the mail. I was able to interview Elmer Smith, who ran the grocery store ran the branch of the Price Cash Store in the early 50s, and he told about how that was the rush period. When the mail came in, he said the women would pull their small children on their sleds, this was during winter, to the village area, to the town site, and they would run into the store for a few minutes and pick up whatever they needed and then wait for the mail. But that was the event for people who were not working in the offices or the mine or were not in school. He said otherwise there wasn't a lot going on for women during the day. But that was a really important part of the daytime social life. As you also saw in these pictures, camp life was seldom casual, consistent, not only with what the stories have been told about Holden, but with the other towns that I researched. There was dressy attire despite the locations. Many of the homes had pianos. Patty Chapin tells me that she thinks that was about the only thing her parents brought when they came from Premier Canada. They had her mother's piano barged down and then barged up like Chelan. They had live music for dances, as you've heard, and that was consistent in every town. You look in the 1930s in the folk directories, every little community had its own orchestra or band. And silver tea services and bone china. One of the stories I was told was about the young professionals' wives who lived at Hollywood, on Honeymoon Heights, pardon me, and had to trek down all dressed up to go to a tea party in one of the circle houses. And how the women complained because their feet got dusty when they were coming down in their dressy shoes. The third thing that really impressed me was the high quality of life. They had good educations and they had teachers who encouraged kids. Remarkably, they had teachers who, by and large, encouraged these kids to think in terms of high school and college. I did not find any evidence that the teachers anywhere tried to keep kids in the community and going back into the mines or into the timber mills. In most cases, these teachers were looking forward and encouraging kids to go out. And in most cases, the company supported that. I mean, Bill's talked about his summer jobs here, but that was very consistent in other towns, especially for kids who were in college. The company provided a summer job, and if you ran out of money and you needed to stay out of school a quarter and work to save, there was a job for you, wherever it was. There was very reasonable cost of living, and there were lots of employer subsidies. For example, here I think the fees for the recreational association were something like 50 cents a month, and that helped pay for the equipment and the magazine subscriptions that were in the community library. And of course, as you all know, this was one of many very lovely sites. So high quality of living when you think about your environment. So those are some things I observed, and what I hope now is that you will share with Rick some of the stories that you have about daily life. Oh, and yes. If you buy a book, I would be happy to sign it.
Yeah.
Return it once it's been signed.
Another 57 cent royalty.
59.
No, sign those
already. Does anyone have any questions for Rick?
I have a question. On your research of company towns, there's probably a spectrum of philosophy of benevolent towns all the way to maybe oppressive towns. Is that in your book, talking about the quality of management?
Not as much as some of the muckrakers would like. Some of the reviews have said that I didn't talk enough about masking unions. I do believe that the towns that were longest lived and the towns that are remembered most fondly was because of the more benevolent leadership or because of company subsidies. I mean, as people have said, this was a very structured life here, and there were certain rules, but I think overall the company was a good dictator, shall we say.
Benevolent,
yeah. I think the worst situations that I observed were in the coal towns, and there's a couple of reasons for that. One is it was earlier. The coal towns in this state, by and large, died out in the 1920s after the national coal strike. And the other thing is those companies did not have resident owners. Those companies were virtually all subsidiaries of the national railway companies. And so they had a hired manager. It was very much like today's conglomerates, where the bottom line was what counted. Where, you know, in a town like this, you had a manager who came and stayed for most of the time that the town existed, and he was a neighbor of everyone. And I think that made a big difference. And there were many, many communities that were one, the company only had one town. For example, McCleary, Washington. Henry McCleary and his brothers lived in that town. Their children went to school in that town. And Henry is well known as being quite the dictator. I mean, there's a comment in the book about a dictatorship is far better than a democracy. It is attributed to him. But also, he was well known for things like, there's a story about somebody who was having his car repossessed, and Henry marched out of his office, went down, and peeled off the bills and paid off the car dealer who was trying to repossess the car. But also, he hated Franklin Roosevelt, and he hated unions, and when Franklin Roosevelt came through here, he pulled all the shades in his office and wouldn't allow him. Did I ever see him? And part of the reason he sold out was the union was trying to get real active in his town. So, but I think you have better or more tolerable community life where there was a very involved owner or manager.
Mm-hmm. Other questions?
Go ahead, sir. Yeah. In your research, did you look at the nature of the single miners?
Single miners here?
The single miners, yes. Most of what I've read in the book, by the way, mostly relates to the family life here. Mm-hmm. But what about the bachelor miners? Most of these dorms are occupied by bachelors.
Right. And most company towns were primarily male. Were built for single men or for men who were willing to live apart from their families. But there's a line in the book that you probably remember that the early bosses, regardless of the industry, said we have three crews, one coming, one going, and one working. And there was high turnover in general in the men who did not have families. And then, there are a number of reasons why. But so it's hard to document their participation in some things. It was very interesting to me, talking about aspect of social life here, to find out that it was very hard for a single miner to attend the formal dances because he had no way of bringing in a date. If he brought in a date, there was no place to house her unless a family offered her lodging. And I hadn't thought through that. I just assumed that the social events were for both the single and married miners. But based on what you people have told me, that was not necessarily true.
Yeah, there weren't a lot of dating opportunities.
I was going to say, you managed.
There's another facet I've never seen it mentioned anywhere, and that's about the displaced persons that were hired here that came from Europe after the war. Many of them were victims of the Holocaust. And we had a number of them. I can remember over 15 of them here at one time. Uh-huh. They were from Germany, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, whatever. And they may have been an arrangement between the company and the federal government to get in there. They were full-fledged employees here and spent several years there. And they were all single men. But they got their start in the United States right here. And most of them were experienced miners. I thought it would be an interesting study to look into that, and there may be a lot of documentation.
There wasn't. That was part of the issue. I mean, because that had been mentioned to me in passing, and I couldn't find anything, I couldn't find any newspaper stories on it. But just to return to the question of single men, I'm sure that's why there was such active sports activity in all of these communities. You had all the basketball teams here. There were so many baseball teams. There was all that bowling. And then there was the never-ending poker game.
Four, five, six. And they had another game called Panditti, which I believe is probably Italian and hard watched. It was like 20 decks of cards. That was going on constantly. It was Panditti. Pan-goofy, the rest of it was called. I didn't know how to play it, that was a major form of entertainment, was the gambling.
But I think that's part of the reason the sports teams were so active. I don't know that they would have been as active in a family community.
No.
Well, as a
is that wonderful book, and Linda's right in the sense that the things she writes about and includes does make a wonderful lead-in for what we're trying to do this weekend. And again, this is to get everyone to think about what it was like here and recall stories and instances of life in this place. We have pretty good documentation of the mining process and a lot of photos of the mine and miners working underground, and miners working in the mill, and a lot of paper documentation of the process and the production and all that went into that. And our hope is through time, when I say our, I mean Linda, who's been working with me in the museum in the summers, last few years, Bill Phillips with his project that he's got going on, and other people that are just trying to preserve the memory of this place. I hope you can appreciate how important that is to the modern day Holden Village, that the memory of Holden Mining Town is preserved and those stories are preserved. The existence of the museum and the investment by the village in taking care of that museum and providing staff positions for that museum, that's a very important commitment to Holden Village, that always these memories live on. And so we keep trying to fill in the picture. That happens at each of these reunion events. It happens when folks send us copies of photos and stories that go along with those. So my hope this morning was to present a slideshow about what life was like for the women here at Holden. And as I sat down to try and put that together, I found out I couldn't. And when I look in our museum collection, we don't have very many pictures of women and the things they did here at Holden. And we don't, that's one of our blank spots in terms of the museum collection. What was it like to be a woman here? And so I have a few images, but this morning really isn't so much about the images. I want us to think together and talk together about your memories of life here and what the community was like. And I'll just have some things on the screen, but we really aren't talking about the photos. We're talking about what memories the photos evoke. What I want to start by finding out who we've got in the room, so that we can talk about that. Are there any women here who lived in Holden after high school, or as in their post-high school years? So we've got just a couple. I know that some of the girls that grew up here married miners, and some of them came back to Holden to live for a short time or a longer time. Either of you two live here as a mom also?
First two children were born here. Yes. A little girl is the granddaughter. I think her mother is the last baby born up here.
Last baby born up here. Now, we're not going to place all the burden of the storytelling just on those two women. We want everybody involved in that. So, by a show of hands, who were kids here?
One in the balcony.
Oh, okay, good. Now, Bill mentioned this, there are a few of the kids that lived here most all of their childhood. Would be in that category. Kids that lived here
my childhood. I was here till I was 13.
Part of the community, I think.
Sure, and we want to include the certain folks in that. Yeah. And
I came back here as a nurse.
Okay.
After I graduated from nursing school. And I was here, and I married a mining engineer up here at that time. And my first child was born while I lived here, up here in Holden.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
So they had a hospital that delivered babies, obviously, up here, huh?
No, she was born in a ranch.
No, we did. The last doctor that came in said, I will come in, and he had an RN for his wife, nurse. And he said, but you'll have, it was hard to get doctors, especially at that point. And he said, I will come there if you will let me do birth babies and do some minor surgery. And so I don't know that there was more than a half a dozen babies actually born here while we were here.
So toward the end of the mine history, there were some births here in Holden.
Yeah, that hospital.
Yeah, what now is the Agape building. Mm-hmm. But it's my understanding that prior to that, when women had their kids, they went out to Comanche.
Prior to that, they did. I think there were maternity homes for relatives.
And the people I talked to, there's some great stories about how long the women went out for. And that they, sometimes they went down to Campbell's and sat and waited going to labor. And then they would come back. Like you said, you came back, you were with your grandparents, and then you came back, your mother brought you back in.
And my mother was staying with our grandparents and with her parents in Seattle. But I had no idea, John, how long you stayed out. I have absolutely no idea because I don't think we ever discussed it. And I would say I was born in March, and there's a picture of me with one of the Adden girls in one of the circle houses, and my mother holding me on the steps. There was still snow on the ground, so I presume that was probably late April, May time period, perhaps about 2 months after I was born, I guess.
But it's a whole lot different than today and your 48 hours in the hospital.
Yeah. I don't know, though. I wasn't born
that. At least you can't talk about it, right?
When the time got close, did the dads come out for the birth?
No.
The one small story that I guess I did hear a little bit, like Bill mentioned, when my sister was born, 2 years younger than myself, and I won't touch on when I was born because I don't know, but Grandma came all the way from Michigan, so she came up here and looked after me while Dad continued to work, so that probably was fairly common to have somebody come
in. I'm sure Don went to work down the mine the day the babies were born. Just which not like today where the mothers come out.
But you also have to remember that at part of this time you were a war effort, and this mine did not shut down. It did not stop for anything. And if a woman had a baby, she had a baby. You know, I really, that's the way you looked at it. I know that our dad never went out. It was, and I think that's true of every male up here. The lady went out and had the baby, and he kept right on working.
That wasn't true. My mother had a baby in 1947. We moved out in 48. And in the summer, she was my 12th birthday present. She was born the day after my 12th birthday. Mother and I went down to Spokane and lived with her mother. My grandmother wasn't alive, but it was my uncle and his wife in the house that my mother was born in. We stayed in Spokane. It's about 2 weeks before she was born, and so she was born in Spokane, and then my father and my brother, who was a year and a half older than I, came down after she was born to see her. And then we went back, I believe in August, so she was there, we were there in Spokane for about 6 weeks. But my father and only stayed, I don't remember exactly, but it couldn't have been very long. We didn't have much of an education.
Yeah. Well, would you like to hear the story about the babies born in the summer?
Oh, yeah.
I was in on my first delivery down there when I was about 14 or 15 years old. This lady decided she couldn't afford to go out to have a baby. So she was sitting in her cabin crying, saying, somebody, please come and help me. Please come and help me. And my mother said, don't you go over there. We'll all be sued. Don't you go over there. I did anyway. And I semi-delivered that kid, but the father got off the shift bus just about the time it was born. And then the year, was that the year I graduated from high school or the year before then? There were triplets born down there. Yeah, this woman had, I'd seen one baby born before that. That was the other one. And I was still a teenager. And they came up, she was in labor, wanting my dad to turn on, that was the Swifts. Do any of you remember, was his name Paul Swift? And they had, I don't know how many kids by then, and she had this first one, and they wanted to turn on the power plant to get some light in there. Well, when we got there, the father had pulled all the wiring out of the house. There were no lights anyway. So by kerosene light, she had that first baby. And I cut the cord, and I was giving this little preemie a bath, because I knew babies were supposed to have baths. Well, they don't do that anymore. And I knew there was something wrong, because this lady didn't get small. By then, they called old Doc Hubbard from Manson, and they got him up there. He flew up, and he delivered those last two babies, and he put them on a cutting board or something and wrapped them all up, the bathed one and the unbathed ones, and took them out, and they never came back. Those kids have been back, though, like, what was it, 2 or 3 years ago to see where they were born. Mm-hmm. Some people in Seattle or over on the coast adopted all three of them, and they've been back, and I have a picture of them when they came back because Buddy down there took a picture of them. And we had some friends that came up. We were up here in May, and we had some friends that came up with us and from Oklahoma, and his daughter, who lives over on the coast, came up, and she is friends with one of those triplets. She talked about a small world, and she came up, and she said, where were they born? So, you know.
Did the mother die, or they just...
Oh, no, she lived. And my understanding is they came up finally and took all these other kids away, and yeah, I was still in high school because they brought the one girl down because she hadn't been in school in 2 or 3 years. She stayed in bed. And I went out and got school books and went up to the hospital. She was in the hospital and tried to do some teaching for some reason. I used to do strange things back then. But the girl wasn't interested, and I don't think she probably could learn. And they took them all. My aunt took one of the boys over on the coast so he could go to high school. And that kid still lives there, and he still comes to all the Getty events. And he's an engineer now, isn't he?
Electrician.
Well, anyway, he went on and he finished high school because of my aunt. He has a profession, and he's married to a nurse, I understand. And there were several other kids, and I don't know what happened to the rest of them.
There wasn't a hospital down there, though, right? They come and just, they delivered in a house. There wasn't a hospital for him.
There wasn't a hospital in Lucerne, right?
Oh, no. Oh. Heavens, no.
Just Brenda in a house.
But back then, I did things that I had no fear. I'd take on about anything. I mean, when I went to nursing school, I did things that nobody else would do because I had the guts to do it. You know? And I've aged since then. I'm smarter. I've gotten a little smarter.
Were the triplets boys, girls?
Girls. They were all three girls.
I went to the high school and I actually left the one girl.
Well, that was another girl because these triplets were adopted over on the coast and they were all raised by the same family.
Really? Well, she says she was born up at Lucerne.
Well, it may have been the other one. I don't know.
Yeah.
Why were they adopted? Well, they were the mother spent the rest of her life, I think, in the mental institution. I don't know whatever happened to the mom. They took all those kids.
At the last reunion, we were talking to Carol, and she was from that family. Maybe she wasn't on the trip.
Carol was one of the girls, one of their sisters was named Carol, another one was named Alice, and then there was a...
So they were all in Indiana.
Yeah.
Well, or put in foster home. Yeah. Alice was the one, I think, that they put in the hospital down there that had been to school for several years.
Uh-huh.
in the hospital where?
In Chelan. I was in high school in
Chelan. Then you came back and nursed.
Oh, here, yeah. I graduated. I came back for a while. And I got married to a man that was up there. And then I had my first child, Malachi. When she was about 6 months old, we lived there, so my.
Well, let's think again about life up here. You've had one of your babies here or two? And what was that experience like? Any different from?
Yeah, actually it was. There's no anesthesiist to know anything. His wife was trained in hypnosis, childbirth under hypnosis, which is now, again, nowadays kind of the thing, but that was in 1955. And so at that point I learned how to have children by using hypnosis, you know, pain-free childbirth.
Who was the doctor?
Diane.
Dr. Bill Miller and Marie Miller. Bill, yes.
Married her in England during the war.
Yeah, Bill yeah. Miller and Marie. And Marie was from New England, and she was a specialist in this hypnosis. And I've used that hypnosis all my life, that same training for pull your teeth and things like that.
Yeah. I have a question about the I understand there's three shifts in the mine, and they kept the mine going 24 hours a day, that kind of thing. Was there any attempt to give the married miners day shift for the benefit of family cohesiveness, or did the women have to do the majority of the parenting?
Or did they have rotating shifts?
All I got was the mumble.
No, they had rotating shifts predominantly. Yeah, you would work. It was 2 weeks rotating, mm-hmm. So you would work all three shifts. And that was pretty much true throughout the mine.
Mm-hmm. And the mill.
And the, I think the mill was the same way, as I recall, but it was rotating every 2 weeks.
My dad was a blacksmith, and he worked only days.
Yeah, blacksmith shop, yeah, there's certain blacksmith shop, I think, just worked during the day.
Yeah, my father's in the carpenter shop.
And that was a daytime.
My father worked the night shift most of the time.
Well, I think it depended upon where you finally got in the hierarchy. In other words, foreman ended up by working, they had their shift, whether it be day shift, night shift, graveyard, you know, whatever. But the miners, I can remember, always rotated.
Was it differential pay? Better pay for night?
Maybe that. As an 8-year-old kid, I wouldn't know.
there was a differential.
Was there?
Yeah, and not only that, but the regular work week was 6 days here. Mm-hmm. You did get time and a half on Saturday, but Sunday's the only day off. And I recall me paid holidays.
And actually, in the early years, in the 30s, it was 7 days a week. Mm-hmm. Because my dad worked 7 days a week for the first 2 years, 3 years, Bill, we found records on. But he that was a 7-day deal when it first started.
I was 7 days until 1939 in July, when the union went on strike. And there was a strike for about 3 weeks, 2 or 3 weeks. I always remember my mother, we had just moved up here, and that was the first permanent job my father had had for 2 or 3 years. And she was so upset with the strike, she just didn't think that should happen. But here we just had gotten here. And then they turn around and have a strike. But it was kind of, it worked out to our benefit because during that time my dad got the logs for our home. And he hauled them by pickup from down the little camp up to the site. And so he had a chance to get a head start on the house during the strike. And then after the strike, everything was fine. And then they went to 6 day
meet.
But tell how your mother would be attended.
Okay.
I've got a question for you. What position? I'm kind of groping here.
He was a diamond driller.
Excuse me?
Diamond driller.
I suspect that maybe there are some specialized positions like that one in particular that maybe those were shift dependent positions and jobs that they did not do those on every shift.
I wasn't a diamond driller, but I was a longhole driller. Year, and I worked only days. So the only shift work was production workers, which would be in the mill, in the mine, where certain machines and different jobs had to continue every day, but when a certain job like diamond drilling, and which is they were only about three crews, and they had their own shifts. They were kind of a separate branch, and then there was the longhole drillers. There was only half a dozen of those. And they were outside of the shift schedule.
It's a good question.
Could, could the people on this side of the room, when you talk, could you talk to our side of the room so we can hear you, please?
Yeah, everybody needs to talk up a little bit louder.
Maybe they stand up and talk. It carries better.
But, we're going to mention something about life in the tent.
Units of emphasis. When we moved up here, in probably in June, I suppose, after school was out, and myself and my five brothers came up on the boat, and my dad had the tent ready for it, two tents. And it was right above the truck bridge. So it almost straight up from that. I think there's a Forest Service thing there now. But anyhow, that's where we lived. And we moved into a tent, and then a smaller tent where three, myself and two other brothers, that's where we slept. That was our bed. And the thing that Eunice was interested in, sometime during July or August, whenever the apricots came in, she got something like 15, 20 cases of apricots. And in this tent, with only a wood stove, and in the heat, the sun's coming down on you, and she canned all of those apricots. And they were delicious, yeah.
This is about the women. She was a hearty. Great lady.
Palm canning was very... very popular. Many men and women did a lot of home canning during those days. And there would be berries here that would be used for jam and jelly, the huckleberries and the elderberries. But people would have the fruit shipped up from Chelan and do the home canning because, again, no grocery store, or even in later years, it was expensive. So there was a lot of, I can remember, that's where I learned to can, was here as a young girl, learned to do home canning.
Same here. I was a child, and my hand hadn't grown to its size now, and so my job was to place the fruit into the narrow jars. My mother couldn't get her hand in, so my job was packing the fruit, and we spent all fall getting ready for the winter, because most of the time I lived up here, there was no grocery store. We ordered it.
Yeah.
Where did they get all the jars for
this
canning?
Well,
Sears
Roebuck. Yeah, bought the jar boards. We had cases of jars. And when we moved out, my father in 1948, he rented this truck, U-Haul truck. I don't know what brand it was, but he brought that truck up on the barge, and he packed all of our belongings into that one truck. And he was such a packer, if you ever saw his rock walls up there, he knew exactly how to fit things together. And the first thing he put in was those canned goods, all in their boxes, in the boxes that they came in. And he stacked those up, and he had the weight perfectly balanced, and those went in first, and he had all that fitted in, so he got every single thing of our household items into that truck. Our bicycles were tied onto the back when they put the back down. He couldn't put the back up. He laid it down and tied the bikes on the back, and that was it. We went off down the road and goodbye.
Helen, there were other things that Mother made, must have, because as I grew up, not in Holden, but she was still making soap and bread, always homemade bread all the time. She kept on making those things even after she didn't have to. But what else did she make? I know soap was, how come they made their own soap?
I really don't know why she did that, but it was a mess.
Some people just like to do that sort of thing.
I think it was sort of like an experiment.
You could order anything from Sears Roebuck catalog in Montgomery Ward back then. Anything.
Mary,
During World War II, soap was very scarce, and a lot of us in the outside world made soap or saved our oil and our lard for somebody else to make our soap.
My husband tells the story of his mother being raised donuts.
Oh.
Raised donuts.
Raised donuts.
And he would come home from school and his job was to shake them in sugar. And eat them at the same time. Probably ate more than her food. And I tried making one.
My mother sewed all her life. And when we lived in Holden, she ordered a sewing machine from either Sears or Montgomery Ward's. And she said she paid for that in no time because she hemmed the miners' pants and fixed pockets. And I know I have some pictures of me modeling a coat she had made for a neighbor, a little neighbor girl, but she, you know, had it on me and took a picture of it. And I know she said she used to get some of the little neighbor girls come in and she would have little sewing classes just to, my sister and I, that kept us busy if she had other people in. And she would bring them in and we would do little sewing projects. So that was something I know my mom did.
Let me ask just a little bit more of a general question. If you think back to your mom while she was here at Holden, what's your strongest image, your strongest memory that still sticks with you of your mom?
I think they were pretty happy women. I there was a real stressful life, and they were filling their needed roles in life. I think all the women were probably very happy and content.
Did they have card clubs or play bridge? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. One of the things they had was a big thing of the year was the bazaar. Mm-hmm. And they sewed dolls and they sewed everything you could imagine, embroidery, everything, to sell at the bazaar. Seems like the money went to some kind of charity.
Hospital guild.
Right.
Yeah, there was my mom worked very much with the hospital guild. And I think there was probably 16 or 20 ladies up here that were very active in that, raised money, that money went back to the outside. I think it was both the Chelan Hospital and Children's Hospital.
I have some articles. When they first started, the Chelan Hospital wasn't even built yet, so they were sending all their money to Children's Orthopedic in Seattle.
I guess that's right.
And then in later years, and they were pretty large groups, in later years they were doing both hospitals. I have copies of a couple articles where they actually, they furnished one entire room in the Chelan Hospital. Another time they bought a new special piece of equipment for the Chelan Hospital from the money that they raised. And the bazaar was a big thing in the earlier years. They had penny drives and they had traveling bake sales and they have a cookbook. I know somebody, a couple people said they thought they had copies of the cookbooks that they made and sold. They raised a lot of money. And they also had their bridge club parties. And in fact, that book that Edith Brewer has in the museum, she had some bridge tallies from some of their bridge parties. So they did have their own social activities too. And they had a birthday club. I'm not sure what
the birthday. Do you not have one of the cookbooks?
One of the cookbooks is in the museum, yes.
Okay. Will the museum be open this week?
Our plan is to have the museum open after lunch this afternoon for a short time. It's not all back together, but most of the Mayan history stuff is back together. So you're welcome to come up after lunch and look around a little bit in the museum.
I believe some of the women had canastic clubs, too.
Oh, yes.
One other thing I wanted to mention, relative to the women, besides the children's orthopedic thing, even some of the women who didn't have children were involved in being the youth leaders for Campfire. They also, like, I know Edith Brewer, they never had a family, but Brewer's were up here almost the entire time the mine was in operation. She was chairman several years of the community Christmas tree thing. That was another big project. So a lot of the women in the community were involved in those youth activities, too.
Den Mothers and the Cub Scouts. I think mothers were more involved in the Cub Scout program than any guy was. And there was, as I recall, there's like maybe 3 Cub Scout dens or something, so there was at least a couple of ladies involved with each one of those, 2 or 3, and very active
in that. And that was really more woman-oriented than it was man-oriented.
I have a question from the peanut gallery up here.
How many kids at any given time were in Holden? Anybody know?
Hundreds.
The year I left, my last year of school, there were 65 in the school. But that didn't include
the younger ones.
Yeah. Or the high school.
Well, high school, there were no teenagers up here during the school year.
Yeah. What year did you leave?
48.
So what year then did they have 120?
The last year the school closed, but that was just the kids that were in school. There were more kids in camp that were not of school age. And again, as I mentioned, the teenagers were still part of the community during the summer. They were just gone to high school, but they were home for holidays and during the summer. So the population was much more than 125.
The Christmas parties were sometimes attended by more than 200 children, and that would have included kids of Holden and kids of Lucerne.
Right. And all ages.
One of the activities I remember was Halloween. That was a big thing. We had scavenger hunts, and the clues were all hidden in the firehouses around town. So we'd go from one to the other, and almost always, in those days that I remember, the snow had already fallen. And we were tromping through snow by Halloween. And then we have a big Halloween party. And I remember one year, my mother kept it all secret from me, but she was the witch. She had this witch's hat on, and she was, and I did not know that was my mother. She told me afterwards. She stood over the cauldron. It was in one of the houses, in the second row.
I think the children had a lot of freedom and security. We didn't have to worry about it. Now, even with the granddaughter who went, we're up here, she went to school. I mean, it's just a safe environment, it always has been.
What Diane touched on a while ago, I had the reality awakened in me one time. You know who lived in your house too, with Tooks?
Yeah.
Marlene said one time that there were a fair number of women who had great spells of depression and cried a lot.
Oh.
And I wasn't particularly aware of it, but apparently both my mother and her mother were. And so even though when you start talking about sewing, I remember, oh yeah, because Mom had the ladies' dress form thing, and so there were a lot of things about the sewing, and I remember the canning too, but there were great times, apparently as kids, and we were out for the fun of it everywhere. We didn't know what it would probably be like for them back home. But the bridge clubs and coming down, I mean, when you start describing Helen, the situation at Helen, I remember coming down this, what they call the slope here, through the chalets, that McCullough would play music outside there at Christmas time, the snow would be falling, and it's just idyllic. You couldn't pick anything better for Christmas time when we had the snow coming and the sounds and the colors and the trees.
My mom worked, I think she worked pretty hard just keeping the family. And I know that we always had a new sweater. You know, she did a lot of knitting, crocheting, and that sort of thing. But I felt like she was always happy, and it was a contented because there was a job. You know, there hadn't been a job before, and then they had a job so they could have a family. I always felt that was good. And she enjoyed just dropping in. I don't know, we don't drop in a whole lot on people today. We have to let them know. So there's a lot of just dropping in.
We didn't have phones or anything.
Yeah,
to drop
we just drop in. And you're always welcome, of course, everywhere. Everybody knew everybody. But we were always, she kept good track of us. I could go down to my cousin's duties for half an hour as long as we didn't quarrel, and then walk home, you know, by ourselves and that sort of thing. Again, a safe but comfortable. I don't know. I think about the winter when we came in, you know, all covered with snowballs on all of our clothes, you know, and we'd only been out 10 minutes, and it had taken her half an hour to get us ready, you know, that kind of thing.
but not too much complaint except for the puddles on the wooden floor.
One of the stories that I think is great, and Bill touched on this yesterday, is how the mothers and the teachers escorted the kids past the avalanche field when you were going to Winston. Did any of you, do you remember who the mothers were? Did they rotate or were there? How did that work?
They took turns, I remember.
And the eighth grade kids also took turns as far as guards. Because I don't know how Mrs. Fields designated it, but I remember the eighth graders standing guard while the rest of the kids went by the
We had the listeners, we had to listen for anything strange.
Our mother was one of the ones that worked while we were up here, at least the last couple of years, because of the cost of getting kids out to school, because my older brother and sister were in the high school. And one of the things, as an adult now, I look back in retrospect, that I think was a little unusual for men in those times, but my dad actually helped some with the household chores. He was a very good cook and did a fair amount of the cooking, which to help her load, because she worked in the bat lunch. So, because it was open in the evenings, on movie days and stuff, she frequently would, quote, swing shift or until it closed at 10 o'clock. And so he helped out with the child care and stuff, too. But in addition to that job, we also still did all the home planning and everything.
Were there any single women up here at all? Mm-hmm. And how did that work? What did they do and where did they live?
Well, there was a couple of single teachers, I think, here for a short period of time that lived in the apartment. That one lady has written an article that's in a museum book, but I think she took ill and was only here a short period of time.
She went up, came up here and she got really high blood pressure. I think she was depressed. She was an older lady.
Yeah,
there were single people that worked in the mess hall.
Right.
And I was single when I came back up here.
Well, and there was another nurse up here named Helen Gray that was single when she, she was here for a while in the 50s.
Who are you?
She was here when we had the polio scare.
Where did the single women live?
Yeah.
They had
a women's bunk.
When Helen was here, she lived in the apartment in the hospital, and the doctor lived in one of the chalets because he had too many kids for the apartment. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was the next one that came. But my mother had an apartment up here when I came back because she was teaching at school, and I just lived with her.
The apartments were in Lodge 4. Three.
Whatever tracks behind Shelley Court.
Yeah, we have apartments.
There were apartments
But that was the question I asked, was before they had the apartments, the waitresses, nobody could tell me where they remembered them. And somebody thought they maybe lived in rooms above the dining hall in the hotel rooms.
Betty Fry, who used to be Sheldon, has been back here a time or two. Ask her, she was one of them.
There was private apartments in people's houses.
Can I remember? Who was the guy that ran the mess hall?
Al Crowley.
Al Crowley. Before him was somebody named
Timmy. He watched those girls like hogs. I know when Betty and Jack Fry were partying, he was sneaking in some, and they were randomly. He'd fire them on the spot.
Oh, yeah. I worked for Al Crowley, and he was very fair, but very strict.
Nothing escaped out.
And some of the people lived at home, like when she came back after college, she worked in one of the offices. She was saving money for graduate school, she told me. And I'm sure she lived with her parents.
She did.
I think her parents left before she left, and I think she lived in the
staff. She lived in the guest house, just like Randall. I thought both Marge and Patty ended up in the guest house. And so every time we call that the VIP, I just knew two girls were there.
And Patty didn't mention it to me. But Patty was married when she was in college, so I didn't know that she came back after college.
Yeah, Patty and her first husband, Crook.
What was his name?
Crook was his last name.
There you go. I want to say Raymond, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't remember his first name. He's actually the one that helped bring TV here, Patty's first husband.
Do you remember Bob Posh?
Yes.
He did a lot with the TV.
I remember Harry Davidson was the one that talked, rated the reflector for a long time.
I think Patty lived with Patty.
Three pairs of sets also.
Yeah, she and I think her husband both lived with it for a while.
Yeah.
I don't think they stayed very long though, did they, before they went?
No, no.
There were quite a few rooms above the dining hall. I know the last summer I was here, the company gave me a job every summer. But this summer I worked in the mess hall. And instead of living at home, I had a room upstairs in the dining hall. And
that may be where they lived too.
That could be where the ladies lived.
They called it the hotel then.
Didn't
they call that the hotel?
Right. Well, maybe
the salesman.
Yeah, they did, because the salesman that came in, the guy that came in to sell the sewing machines or the Shirley Rollins used to come in with these woolen stuff. They stayed up there.
Or a brush man.
Yeah.
And he came back and pretended to be
the dentist.
He bought a lot of stuff from the man. Charlie Rollins.
I think we may be talking different times because this was 1942 when I was working there, and I don't know what happened after that. And I don't remember if I paid for that room, and I had my board naturally, and they were part of my pay. I don't recall.
Joe's not here, so I can't ask him. But Diane said they didn't have telephones, but Joe's folks had a phone, I guess because he was the marshal and the fire chief. Because when our first daughter was born, Joe called up here and it was a relay thing.
A few did have a
certain
phone.
There were a few phones on the corners.
Yeah, okay.
There were a few phones in Holden. There was one in Lucerne, there was one at Better Creek, and at one time there was one at Belkie Lake.
Yeah.
And they were these wires that they strung all the way up.
Phones are on the basis of company hierarchy. For example, in the mine, every mine foreman had a phone. We had a phone. But it was on the basis of emergency response.
Transportation guys had them.
Whatever. I mean, there's certain key positions, and then those phones all worked on the same, four long, one short, or whatever.
So that's the reason they had a phone, right?
But you were, like, as kids, we could not talk on the phone. The phone was strictly
business.
Company business.
And you could call Snodgrass down at Chelan if you had something, and he'd transmit messages.
Yeah, it was all on transmission now.
Yes. Because
I think that was Forest Service.
Joe called someone and they could get a message up here.
And he was
correct, but it was all transmission. You couldn't talk directly to Chelan. We couldn't.
Everyone answered the phone.
He did the hiring.
Yeah, and he was also
an hour later.
And
that's
Lucerne,
not right. They didn't have a girl.
Lucerne didn't have to go through anybody. They went,
so
the
he
went
for Lucerne was
1913. I remember that.
One more
confirmed it was a girl.
I thought there was a Forest Service telephone line that was used.
That may have been a Forest Service line, but you could call out on it and they could call in.
That's right.
Yeah, there was a phone at Chelan Falls that you could call up and get to the operator up here. But I remember our dad stopping at one point down. We had to go down to Chelan Falls, and he had to make a call up here. But it was all a relay.
Okay, as best I can recall, I wanted to tell you, because Warner Jensen and I worked on the equipment that provided the phone service here in the village when the village first opened up, that had the capability to do it. The question is whether we were going to reinstitute it. So at the dam, when it actually had the high voltage lines initially, they had the carrier control equipment to be able to put the telephone conversations on the high tension lines, and they could go up. When she mentioned memory, if that was part of, if they actually had a transformer there, that meant they had power there, but at least that's how Lucerne got the same thing. You had a high tension box transfer carrier control, and then there was one up at the top landing. Mom was on the switchboard. She did all the patching of the conversation, so she knew where everybody was. And we happened to have one in Shelley 14, and all we did was ring up and complain to Mom because we didn't even have to dial to anybody. She answers.
I was wondering if anybody remembers the tennis court.
No, I don't need to.
My mother tried to get a tennis court built because she was a tennis player. My father had been on the tennis team at Washington State College. It was before the time girls could play.
Emotional divide that these positions are becoming so emotionally entrenched. Is this something that's new? Is this something that has happened through every generation and we're just experiencing a new version of it? And if it is new, why is it that it is becoming so emotionally entrenched so that we can't talk to each other any longer?
Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Don from the Peninsula, Michigan. The answer to your questions, we've gone through this periodically, most famously during the Civil War. Father shot son, brother shot brother, over one issue. And that issue was slavery, of course, in the Dakota Country Park. The issue regarding the church's involvement with homosexuality would be the same thing. It's a church splitter. It's destroyed a number of churches in the Peninsula already. It's a very volatile and dangerous situation. I'd like to also contribute to two definitions. A conservative is somebody who deeply realizes that change is necessary, but does not want the government to be the agent of that change. Once a church or a group or whoever changes, a liberal is somebody who sees the need for change, even if there isn't any, and wants the government to be the agent of that change. I think that those are two terms that are thrown around all the time and nobody knows what they're talking about.
Right.
Or what they're to understand. So I just dropped it on us so we can think that through.
Thank you, Darrell.
Yes. My name is Suzanne. I live in Spokane and I vote Democrat. My issue with talking to my brother is that, I'll be honest, I think he's wrong. And he thinks I'm wrong. And it's not something that we can set outside of ourselves about, they shouldn't have gotten drunk last night. It's something that affects people who think in the way that he does, and he knows that what he believes is what God wants. And so then that's, infers that I'm not part of God. It adds this other dimension to when more and more people believe in opposed ways, the movement, the change that they bring about, each of them is working for change, the change radically affects me personally. It affects how my country is perceived internationally. It affects the planet, and they're not minor issues. They're not things that are going to go away. I feel like it's too important to not speak out.
How do we do it?
And I don't know. I don't know how to talk about things that I think are so important.
I'm Tanya from Iowa also. Grew up in Michigan, lived in Iowa. We lived in Vegas, Phoenix, Tucson, back to Vegas, been over a 10-year period of time. Now we're back to Iowa, and we're visiting here. Coming here has been, and living in Vegas, Phoenix, Tucson, back to Vegas, we've been in a lot of different unique situations, but this was even more unique. one, I guess, the first night and having been talked to from the pulpit like we were talked to, and sitting there and feeling like, because I'm more conservative, because I'm from Iowa, but I'm not, but okay, and because I may vote Republican, that I don't support ecological minded things, that I don't feel that organic growing foods, and I really love all that too, that because I believe in some other directions of things, I have very much felt like, because of who you perceive me to be, you assume that, and I think that's where some of the discussion stops, is because we assume that you believe the way you believe and I believe the way I do, and there's not common ground, where I think we do have some common ground and we need to start there. Number two, Bill Clinton was in office for 2 4-year terms. I prayed for that man, I supported that man, and I didn't say anything derogatory about him while he was in his presidential office because he was my leader. The Bible tells me that I am to support and pray for whoever's in leadership. This is where I get, bottom line, where I get really tweaked, is because there is so much bashing if it is from the other side. And go down and look in your bookstore and see some of the books that are down there. The reasons why Bush needs to be out of office. I mean, and then you've got the Bill Clinton. I just wish that if we really take the Bible, and that's my first question, to believe that this is the Word of God and it's ordained, and this is where we follow, or is it good stories, some good guideline kind of things? That's the first, to me, if we're not believing that this is truth and ordained and the Word of God, then we're not going to come together and agree, because we're already not foundationally at that same point. But I want to listen, I want to hear, I want to love, I want to care, but there are going to be some things that I'm not the age of your dad, and there are things that you and I aren't going to agree on, but that doesn't mean that we can't start caring, and this is a beginning. This is a way huge beginning. But I think if you're assuming, and your dad's assuming, things that you haven't even verbalized yet, that's why we can't talk to each other, because we are assuming that if that person is dressed that way, or their hair is this way, or the tattoos or their earrings, well, my goodness, they can't be a Christian, or my goodness, they can't believe this way or that way, where we need to stop. We just need to stop. And I think I would have more respect for the Democratic side of things is if there wasn't such negative coming towards the people that are in office. I just feel that's very disrespectful, and it is not balanced on what God calls us to do. I had to. I did it for 8 years. I wasn't a happy camper, but I did it. You know, and if I can do it and I screw up and I'm not a perfect person, why can't the nation do that too? That. So those are some of where I've been, and it's like I said, it's almost like you have a society living here that you've pulled yourself away from what's going on in the rest of America and the rest of the world, and you've lost touch with who I am, too, you know? And there's a lot of good ones of us that are in the main states and really fighting for good things too. I may not vote the same way you do, but I really want the best for my children and my future grandchildren and great-grandchildren. So,
thank you.
We'll go first times for everybody first.
I'm Harry. I live here at Holden, and I'm probably to the right, I'm left of center. Your earlier question, and part of the follow-up on this, is, for myself at least, my political views and opinions are a lot formulated by my faith, and I'm talking about the basics of more basic, I think, than theology, but in my image of God, and I think that's where a lot of people's theology and beliefs derives. And for myself, I don't believe the Bible is the literal word of God, but I put more emphasis on the life of Jesus, and I feel he taught a gospel of love and of nonviolence and unconditional love and acceptance, much like the first woman mentioned of her grandmother. And I also hope that maybe that gospel of love might be where we find a common ground that you can later, you know, at least talk about our different interpretation of Scripture and our political views that derive from it.
First of all, I think this is quite worthwhile, and maybe not always comfortable, but the comments, I think, are really good. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm Bruce Bishop. Do the pottery thing.
Can you speak up?
I'm Bruce Bishop. I do the pottery thing here. I don't know. It does seem like compromise is in order on some level, somehow. And maybe that just comes from a lot of dialoguing and listening and understanding how one side has gotten to the position that they're in. I think, you know, there's a statement that these personal morality issues weren't really focusing in on the heart of what we're talking about, politics. I disagree. I think it's very much a part of the political scene, and has a whole lot to do with how we see what's going on in Iraq. So issues of homosexuality, issues of abortion, I think have to be dealt with and worked through. I come from a Mennonite tradition, and which has a very strong scriptural basis for their for our stance, but also sees Jesus Christ as being a pacifist. And sees the importance of not taking life. You know, it's real central at the Mennonite. I have appreciation for the situation that people find themselves in, and I'm not going to go exactly into my stance on abortion, but if I guess in terms of in the spirit of compromise and trying to find a way of bringing some stuff together. If what I find satisfying is what's called a consistent life ethic, and that's where we as Christians work towards the reduction of abortion. We work towards the reduction and elimination of war. We work towards the reduction and the elimination of capital punishment. We are for life across the spectrum, not just in our own little chosen area that we happen to like. That's, I guess that's all I have to say.
Thank you.
Yes.
My name is Bob Hawkins. I think one of the reasons that things are as polarized today as they are, and one of the reasons the compromise that you speak of is less possible, is because of some of the practical political changes that have taken place in the country over the last 20 or 30 years, in that politics is much more of a winner-take-all than it has been previously. You know, back in the 60s, some of us more liberal thinkers and advocates really pushed for opening up government so that there's no longer secret meetings, closed sessions of Congress. CNN is there, the lobbyists are there watching every move that people make. Whereas congressmen used to have 3 months to work out a compromise with their colleagues, their own thinking and all that, you now have 3 minutes. That's made a big difference, so that we have much more of a true democracy and much less of a representative government than we've had. So that we're really not electing representatives anymore. At the state level, legislators control about 15% of the budget. The rest of it is dictated by referendum initiative and recall, the way state governments are being run. So there's much more of an atmosphere, I think, of winner take all, and I think it's extremely polarizing. Now, how we deal with that at this point, I'm not sure, but I think that the tension that we're sitting with in this room is a result of some of those practical changes.
Thank you. You get a second minute there, Nick. Make it quick, someone on
the line. Hi. With what Bruce was saying and Tom?
Bob.
I know where I was supposed to. Was saying with compromise, I don't think compromise is necessary. Well-meaning people can disagree, but we all can pretty much agree on what needs to be done. What we don't agree on is how is the best way to do it. We all agree that a deficit is bad. We all agree that war is not the best choice to be following. We all agree that our children should be educated and have the best opportunity to succeed in the future. We all agree on the basics. How we go about accomplishing those goals is where the problem comes from. I personally believe that if something was to actually get done, if progress was to happen, if these goals were to start to be achieved, this dialogue would become irrelevant because we would all be in agreement that things were happening and moving in the right direction. How we get there, It's almost Machiavellian. The ends justify the means. And yes, that's callous and cold-hearted, and Machiavelli got shot for it. But I think that that's an important element to add to this discussion.
I don't know how many of you have ever watched C-SPAN, but what really gets me is that if you watch the Senate and the House, we've had many laws come up during the year, and they get going and they get the bill out there, and something gets voted on, and then once the Republicans will spend 3 days bashing the Democrats, and the Democrats will spend 3 days bashing the Republicans, and nothing gets done. Then something stalemate. Somewhere along the line, they've got a compromise. Now, this year, the Republicans did something a little bit different, which I don't quite agree with completely either. They've had conference committees before, every year. This year, they put 3 members on a conference committee, and of course what they did, what was wrong, is they put 3 of their own people on. They didn't put 1 Democrat in there. Before, there was 10 and 10, and the ruling party has chairmanship. So that we know just exactly about what comes. But I don't know how many of you have ever been on a board with 20 people or 25 people on it. Nothing ever happens. Nothing ever happens. I mean, it's hopeless. If you're 5 or 7, yes, something can happen. And there will be compromise, but they will not, and it really, and the second point is I'm making that the presidential race is costing way too much money. All that money should be channeled into something much more useful.
Sounds like you found a point of agreement. Yeah. Sure, there's some reform there.
I'd like to rebut one of the professor's remarks when you said we're all pretty sure that war is not the answer. That's not true. Name the National Peace College. We don't have one. Name the National War Colleges. We have 5 of them. We don't train. See, what happens, I think, is we believe in myth. Our soldiers are great, good guys. The other country's soldiers are bad guys. Both countries train people to kill one another. As long as we support that, that's what's going to happen. Maybe something, a meeting like this, somebody could come up with the idea of why don't we have a peace college? I've been so taken with the education of people in this village. Why couldn't every kid go to a school like that? Why doesn't the Lutheran Church have its own grade schools? Instead of letting the government do everything. When the government does something we don't like, then we don't complain. Why give them the power in the first place?
Well, thank you, Tom. This has been a treat that we got this chance to spend together. I hope it'll engender more conversations amongst us and perhaps more opportunities like this. But before we go, if you take a chance to thank 3 other people before we go, it was because we got together that it was such a wonderful time. So thank you for the blessing of it. Thank you very much.